And also what? I'm sorry.
And also show you know, anything that I've done that could be helpful as well.
That's awesome. Okay. Anybody else?
I'm just going to mute people who may have some problems with their phones. And if you want to talk, just write in the chat and I'll unmute you.
Okay. So one of the things that, just for those of you that are new, I mean, I think this is a very, I like to think of it because, you know, it's a clinical affinity group. So that means we're all kind of fluid in terms of what we choose to talk about. But I think for those who've been on the call several times, the thing that's terrific about it is that we really have an opportunity to sort of talk to other humans around the country that are sort of dealing with the same kinds of issues. And the issues that we've dealt with are things having to do with clinical programs. We've talked about, last time we spent a lot of time talking about psychiatry. I think just, you know, we talked about kind of the makeup of our programs. One time we talked about like whether we're doing addiction work and things like that. And we find that there's a lot of kind of shared, you know, my feeling is that I've been the clinical director at this agency for 27 years. And I find that when our programs are so in the weeds, you know, and dealing with day in and day out, saving people's lives, if you will, that sometimes we sort of need an opportunity to step back and talk to our colleagues and say, hey, are you struggling with figuring out what insurance companies to use or not use, or do you bill, or what's your sliding scale, or how you manage fees, or how we make money as a department? Everything from that to, it could be that we have a call one time where everybody is struggling to figure out how to deal with people that are, you know, have schizophrenia. Is that something we do in terms of severe and persistent mental illness in our programs? So it's all kind of up for those of you new on the call. It's really open to, you know, what it is that sort of shared of interest and concern, where we, and at the end of our discussion today, I actually have a question to throw out to everybody that I'm kind of hanging on to that came from a discussion that some of us were having here yesterday. So today what we were going to talk about is issues related to how we're managing fees, billing, what we're charging, if we're using insurances, so I'm going to just kind of open it in terms of challenges people might have. I mean, I'll just give you a broad picture. For example, you know, we have a counseling team here of about 12 professionals. We accept Medicare plus many third-party insurances, and we do not take Medicaid. And one of the things that we've been struggling with and realizing is that we're losing our shirts on some of these insurance companies that basically don't even cover the cost of an hour of doing business for one of our therapists. So there's always the conversation about, should we keep insurances? Should we not? Should we drop insurances? Should we go private pay only? And we've not done that yet. I will tell you that in terms of our psychiatrists, we did kind of go that way. We have two psychiatrists, and in terms of our child psychiatrists, we are only accepting private pay and one insurance company. The other insurance companies we're not accepting because we can't cover her cost. So, and we have a sliding scale that goes from $125 at the top down to $45 at the bottom. And that would be an interesting thing that, I mean, I think we want to kind of hear from each other about that too, because the other thing about that for us is it may go from 125 down to 45. The question is, how do you determine that 45, and what happens when somebody says, but I can't afford the 45? So that's the other issue too. I mean, I'm throwing out a lot of points and then I'm just going to be quiet and let you all take it away, because the other issues related to that is, you know, for us, we have different pots of money that come from the Jewish Federation and monies that don't come from the Jewish Federation. And, you know, I have a different sliding. I can slide down to $45 for a Jewish client, but we slide down to $55 for a non-Jewish client.
So yeah. I think that's really, you've given us a lot to think about.
Oh, you don't want me to keep going, Lisa? Tell you all the things. Okay, I'm going to stop talking. I was going to stop talking right now.
No, I just meant because I think that people can probably respond to a lot of what you said.
Absolutely. So I'm done and take it away.
Yeah, Rachel, come on in.
Okay, so we're a much smaller program here in Charlotte, but we have a somewhat similar process, I think. So we do take Medicare and Medicaid and several third-party private insurance. The difference being, and our sliding scale is only funding only for the Jewish community. So our mental health services for insurance is for anyone in the Charlotte area. And we get referrals through, you know, physicians. We get a lot through Psychology Today. But in the, for the Jewish community only, and it's partially funded through our allocation through the Federation and then just through our general philanthropy, we have a sliding scale that goes down to
$5. $5, wow.
Income and you know, household number of people in the household, but it's only for the Jewish community. So when somebody calls in and they don't have our insurance, then we would tell them the full rate, which I have to double check, but I think it's $120 an hour.
And if somebody, Rachel, if somebody can't afford that, what happens?
We would refer them somewhere. So if it's, if they're not, so we say, are you a member of the Jewish community? Or are you a member of the Jewish faith? I can't remember exactly how, you know, our front desk has a script. And if the answer is no, and they can't afford that, then we would refer them to one of the many other agencies in the community that have sliding scale or low cost counseling services for the general community. And if they are Jewish, then we work with them on a sliding scale. Now let's say their sliding scale puts them at $40 a session and they say, I can't do $40 a session. We say, what can you pay? And if they say $5 a session, we do $5 a session.
Okay.
But again, that's a small, you know, that's only the Jewish community and we're just in Charlotte. So it's a, you know, very different numbers game.
So what do other people do? Because I think a lot of agencies do that until their board comes down on them and says you can't do it anymore.
Yeah,
you lose your shirt.
Lisa, it would be great. I mean, I would love somehow, because I'd love to get that answer from all of us and somehow either, you know, create, get it via email or create a document or whatever we do, because just even that, like that issue of the Jewish, non-Jewish, the fees, what we're charging, and the script of what we're saying to people who call in not Jewish would be very helpful, I think, to share with everybody.
So right now, do you want people to respond to that? Is that
I think so. Did other people want to respond to what Rachel, like what Rachel said?
Or what they do?
Yeah.
So in Montreal, in Canada, we don't have private pay insurance companies at all. So either the clients will pay for the service themselves, and if they can't, it's subsidized from at least in Montreal, from our federation. At the Cumming Center, we don't provide counseling, but we support one of our sister agencies, who's also a member of actually the network, is OMET. And we will ask the same question, are you from the Jewish faith? And then we ask them what they could afford to pay, and we will subsidize the difference through the monies we get from federation.
And do you do any kind of verification, Beth? If they say, well, I can only afford $20.
No, so we also have an extensive financial assistance program for vulnerable seniors, and we use the same criteria, which is quite a detailed process. They have to supply us their income tax return, their notice of assessment, copies of bank statements, and we ask if they own their own home or condo, and that criteria has to be filled before we'll even have a conversation about what they could afford for that kind of a service.
And how about for the non-Jewish community?
Sorry?
And for the non-Jewish community?
We don't provide any financial support for any service for the non-Jewish community, except for one area in the organization, but it's not in social services.
So that's
how about other people? Is that how they do it? They don't provide financial assistance to non-Jewish
people? In Stamford,
people?
Connecticut, here at Shoki Jewish Family Service, we provide sliding scale for counseling for anybody, as long as they prove need. The only restriction regarding whether or not you're of the Jewish faith comes in into play in our case management department for financial assistance. We will not help support people through their financial crisis unless they're of the Jewish faith.
You're going in and out.
Eve, we're having a hard time hearing you.
We do sliding scale for counseling for everybody, as long as you prove need.
Right. Interesting.
We do the same in Birmingham.
Okay. Birmingham does the same. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. This is Jane. My question is, how many organizations have a billing department doing all this, and how much of it is put into the clinical world?
So, Dory from Winnipeg, you have an answer to that? You were nodding your head.
Well, we have someone on staff who handles the billing.
Okay. Yes. How many? Raise your hands if you can, and if you're in chat, let us know. If you can't see you, how many has someone doing billing? So, over half of the people, most of the people I can see here, are they have their own separate billing department. Okay.
No, actually, the billing, a lot of our billing is done by the professional staff.
Right. Okay.
But so how much of the
billing responsibility
is put on to any of the clinical? The clinicians or receptionists or any of them that are serving the people?
Well, so
anyone can answer. I'm going to mute you guys, Jane, because you have some weird sound coming out. I'll unmute you when it's time.
Okay. So for us, I guess it would be kind of a hybrid because we have our electronic health record. You know, our front desk staff does practice management end of things, such as scheduling and creating the file in the electronic health record, which then creates the progress note that, of course, the clinician fills out, which then creates the super bill that gets sent to the clearinghouse. This is how it works here, where the billing happens. But we do have one administrative staff that does the billing as far as, you know, chasing bill. Claims that are not getting paid and that kind of thing. It's not a department, but it's sort of a one person, and then the clinicians have to complete their portion of it. So it's like a two-person administrative team, and then the clinicians doing their part in the EHR. I don't know if that's helpful.
So the way that we work now, and I guess this is a new process, is that we require the client to pay their fee on the way into their appointment. And so our receptionist handles that. And if we're in Winnipeg in Canada, so if they need a receipt for their private insurance, he emails it right away.
What happens if someone doesn't pay?
They don't go in to see their therapist.
So you are strict about that. That's really, you know, impressive.
Yeah, but I just also wanted to add that we do service Jewish and non-Jewish clients, and our sliding scale is $10 to $95. So we're on the lower end of the spectrum, I guess.
And how much do you pay your therapists?
Well, we only have changed to our high of 95 just this week. Before it was 65.
Wow.
And the reason that we had to up it was because we were having a hard time finding therapists. Mm-hmm. They're all contract counselors in our counseling department.
How many people here have contract counselors in their counseling department? Or do they have full-time staff?
We have one contract counselor for child and family, and then we're a pretty small department. We have four full-time clinicians, and three of them are LCSWs and one is an MSW.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, you were going to say something.
Yeah, we have. So my department has been growing over the last couple of years since I took over the department. We have a fee for service model, so all the clinicians except for me, I'm the only full time salaried staff on the department. Everybody else is a fee-for-service. And what we pay for our clinicians per session, not per hour, per session is $40, well, $35 to $40 depending on their license.
And what's your lowest, what's the lowest you go in your?
Oh, the sliding scale. So our sliding scale, we, it said at $25 at the bottom and we go all the way up to $125, I believe, that's what we cap. It's based on income, so, and we do, we kind of keep it more mission aligned with our agent's mission, so we don't deny anybody, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, services. We do have some grants that are specific to our Jewish community. However, we just don't turn people away, especially because we are one of the very few providers in South Jersey that actually takes Medicaid. And we do take Medicaid, Medicare, and a few commercial insurances. So I actually just got out of a meeting a couple hours ago, talking with a couple of other directors of just local agents, mental health agencies, and just trying to come up with, I was picking their brain on like renegotiation of rates with the insurances. So I'm actually gonna be engaging in that with one of our commercial insurances in the next few months.
I'm very curious about what you just said, Carlos. Have other people been successful at doing that, at actually going to the insurance companies and negotiating for higher rates?
Yep, actually, so I used to work in a chiropractic in Philadelphia, and when we worked there, I know that our group practice renegotiated groups with a few insurances. I know CompSec was one of them, and I want to say Cigna possibly, but I'm not sure about that one. I'm going to be tackling Aetna in the next few months. And what was shared with me from a couple of the other directors, on they were actually fairly successful on actually renegotiating rates.
Are you finding that do you guys think it's state specific, or is that something in terms of these insurance companies that in terms of the network we could go after as a whole?
Well, so one
of
the
things, we'd have to look into it. Yeah.
One of the things that I would actually suggest that for the larger insurance companies, so something like Verizon on in Jersey, is for me to speak with the directors of all the other JFCS agencies in New Jersey to kind of come as a one united, hey, we provide so much services to so many of your members.
That's a good idea to do it by, like, if we did with the other Florida JFSs. I know there's a few other Florida people on the line here.
Right.
That would be an interesting thing to do.
It would be. Eve has been trying to talk. Yeah.
I was just wanting to share that one of the ways that we try and make a little more money is that we use our interns for those who are under or uninsured for the sliding scale low fees. And so the clinicians who are insurance reimbursable only see those who have insurance, and those who are underinsured are assigned to interns.
So do other people use interns in that way? That seems like a good way to make money, is what you're saying. Right.
Right.
But does anyone else do that?
I don't know that it's a good way to make money. Interns are there for a learning experience, so I don't know that it's necessarily profitable, but it is a way for us to serve clients without insurance coverage.
Yeah, we actually just started doing that. I have one of my psychologists that's supervising a fourth year doctoral student, and so we can use her, Eve, like you said, just for that, particularly for the right. Jewish clients who really can only afford like $10 or $5 a session. It really helps that way.
So this is Roseanne from Chicago. So one of the things that we're really fortunate to have is Title 20 block grant money. So we're able to serve clients it's bad if they're uninsured. So we actually don't have a sliding fee scale for uninsured clients that aren't able to use that other grant funding in a really helpful way.
That's federal?
Yes.
Can you say more about what that is?
So, and I don't know that it's, so it's federal money that comes into the state of Illinois and is dispensed this way in the state of Illinois. So I don't know if it's treated the same way in other states or not. But in Illinois, a sizable portion of that money is used for counseling services.
Wow.
And we're actually, and we're actually able also to provide care management and counseling combination services with that.
What is that grant called?
So it's Title 20, also known as DFI, Donated Funds Initiative.
Wow. Thank you. Interesting information.
Yeah, it's really our safety net.
Wow.
And then and I do ask when especially if we're getting to the bottom of those funds, I will ask if a family needs a Jewish agency or not. I don't ask if they identify with the Jewish community, but I will say, what's your reason for coming to this agency, and really teasing out if they're really looking for Jewish services, then we're going to find a way to serve them.
Who does are you the one who does the intake or the exploration?
I'm doing, we have an intake staff that gets initial information, and I do the screening financially.
I wonder if you should mute your phone and unmute your box so that you're not.
So my problem is my computer sound is not working.
Okay.
I can't hear you.
So Carla, did you want to respond? I muted you. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. We're just going to respond to the intern question. I do have interns, but I found it as kind of like a double-edged sword, if you will, because if the interns that we only have for X amount of time, so when I do assign clients to them when they're starting to scale, and the intern leaves, then those clients have to be seen by another person, and and they will still remain by themselves. However, in New Jersey, we actually are allowed to use social work interns and bill Medicaid. So if we want to, as part of their learning experience, when they have clients, I actually tend to give Medicaid clients to the interns, because then we can bill for the close clients, making a profit basically, and then those clients are easily transferable after the intern leaves.
You can bill Medicaid for interns
in New Jersey? Yes.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, as long as the intern is being supervised by an approved supervisor.
Right.
I'm jealous.
So Dan, did you have something you wanted to say? You're frozen. Do I have to unmute you? No, you have to unmute yourself. Okay. You muted yourself. Unmute it again. Click it again. There you go.
So I think?
Yes, that's working.
Okay. So, one, I'm sorry to join the conversation late. So we are not Medicaid providers at all, because Georgia certainly did not approve Medicaid expansion, and we're not able to get paid for Medicaid for mental health services. Y'all may have already had this conversation. I'm curious if folks are actually actively limiting the number of low-fee clients that you will see.
I'm interested in that also.
Did he freeze?
No, I think we're all pondering.
So that was my big question. We're certain. We take insurance.
It's hard to hear you.
Okay, I don't.
I don't know why, but that's okay. Keep on going.
I don't know. You know, I think we're probably similar to a lot of the agencies, a lot of the other agencies. But again, I'm looking at, you know, it's the mix of higher fee or mid-range fee clients and low fee clients. And I'm curious if folks are kind of limiting the number of low fee clients.
Are you? Dan, are you?
We are not, no. And our revenue is suffering as a result.
Right.
Okay, so Stacy, okay, people are writing back. I'm finally realizing people have been writing the whole time. So Stacy from Denver says they limit the percentage of SFC. What's that in Colorado? Rachel doesn't in Charlotte. They don't in Minneapolis.
Okay.
Well, what is SFC? And I'd like to know how, for those that limit the number of low-fee clients, I'd like to know if you could write back how you limit them, and do you limit that for the Jewish community too? So if you have a Jewish client who cannot afford to pay, are you sending that client away?
Minneapolis doesn't limit, and neither does Portland. Most of their clients, however, in Portland are Medicare.
Who does limit? Does anybody, Minneapolis limits.
So you want to talk about how you made that decision?
And how you do that?
Jill, do I have to unmute you? There you go. Jill, can you talk about how you made that decision?
Because we all want to be like Jill, but we don't know how to do it.
Can you hear us? Can you talk? I don't know. Jill, are you there?
Jill, come back to us.
Well, anyway, Chicago doesn't limit, but has grants to support, right, the service costs.
Right.
Well, whoever limits, it would be interesting to hear how you do that. It's hard to say no.
But we have kind of had a percentage at one point. It originally was a 10% client, so fee for service, and then it's been increased to, I think, we're at 18% now.
Okay.
I don't think it's that we've had a hard line of here's the number, but we certainly keep looking at the numbers.
Right.
So consistency, say under the 20%.
Under what?
The 20%. Bill does not, Jill doesn't, they don't limit Minneapolis after all is said and done.
We need somebody who limits. We want to know how to do that.
Does anyone
when you say, 20%, you keep, What do you mean by that? Can you say more?
I mean, 10% of times that are fee for service, we kind of keep it at that. After that, it's just insurance and basically just insurance.
I can't hear you, Carlos. I can't understand you.
I'm sorry. No, 20% is just the number of fee for service clients. We actively try not to have fee for service clients unless we have to.
Can you write that in the chat? It's really hard to understand what you're saying.
And I'm also trying to understand when you say fee-for-service clients, are those the clients that you slide their fee for? Is that what you're referring for?
Yeah, it's sliding fee clients, sorry.
Okay. The what?
Those are the ones that we have a sliding fee for.
And so you try to limit the numbers who are on your sliding scale to 20%?
Right.
Okay.
That's interesting. You know, one of the things that our CEO, who used to be our CFO, so he's a real numbers guy, has been talking about is one of you mentioned it, I think, which is the idea of looking at caseloads and looking at the mix. He talks a lot about the mix, that we probably wouldn't be losing our shirts as much in these programs if we started to look at the mix between the high-paying clients, the low-paying clients, measuring that against what the therapist is making. So if we knew that, for example, like I have therapist A, so therapist A, somehow we figure out that if she's seeing 30 clients, 20% of those can be in this fee range, you know, 10% in this fee range. That's sort of one approach of looking at stuff. And if they max at that percentage, then they have to go to a different therapist. You know, then maybe they're not assigned to that therapist. It's just a thought of another way to do this.
Does anyone do that in their own, in their practices at the agencies? Look at it that way?
We're not doing it either, but that was something that he had suggested.
Okay, that would be, everyone silent? What's happening?
That would seem like a difficult other issue to balance in terms of therapist caseloads. One of the things I can say, when we've been full on our grant, what we have done is hold a small wait list for that program, so that if people are told they're going to get services for free, they're fine sitting on a wait list until we can absorb them and or given the option that they can see an intern.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys have wait lists overall? How does it go in terms of the flow for your counseling programs? Can we talk about that for a second? It's a little off topic perhaps, but
We have wait lists in our child adolescent program and in our older adult program. Our general adult counseling, we're typically able to meet the need. Kids and older adults, we maintain waiting lists.
And that's because why? You don't have the therapist, you don't have the hours available?
So most of our older adults are seen in their homes. And we're at capacity. And with kids too, not that they're seen in their homes, but I just added two new child adolescent clinicians because we're perpetually at wait list serving kids.
That's good. That means your program's growing. Are you making money? Is anyone making money? Let me ask that question. Is anyone making money on their counseling programs? No.
No.
We made money last year. We're not making money this year so far.
That's why we're all on the phone call, Lisa.
But so is the reason that we're not making money is because we're not charging enough, or because we're so kind and mission-driven that we allow people to come in to receive the services at a much lower fee? And we pay our therapists more than what we're making. I mean, that's what happens.
So can I ask a related question? And I tried to type this in the chat. Are most people's therapists, are your staff salaried? Or is most of your staff contract?
We have something in the middle, Dan. All of our staff, we went away from the salary model many years ago because there was a lot of dead space time and people started looking at hourly cost and all that stuff. So we went to this model called direct service units, where somebody, they are employees of the agency, and they can get benefits. So if they do the equivalent of 30 direct service units, 20 direct service units is the equivalent of 30 hours of employment. So they're eligible for benefits. And 25 direct service units is the equivalent of full time. So they really only get paid when they see a client. But what's interesting is
that they get salary, they get benefits?
Yeah, if they work that number of DSU, if they see that many DSUs a month.
What happens if they do 1 month and not another month? I mean,
We actually, when the system first started, we look at their trends, and the truth is if there's a period of 3 months, if there's a quarter where 3 months in a row they dip below that and they don't maintain it, they could be eligible. They could wind up losing their benefits.
Oy, 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 that is risky.
It's risky, but it's also, the therapists have actually liked it because, in a sense, they control how much money they make.
And they how much do you pay the therapist?
Somewhere between, depending on how long they've been here and their degrees, I would say between 44 and 50, probably.
And you make 100?
Do we what?
How much do you make on that?
How much do we make on it? You mean, I guess it depends on what we're charging for the session. And we lose money. That's our CEO's frustration, because if we're charging that much for them, if that's what they're getting paid, remember there's also, you know, all the ancillary things that go into employment, right? So there's Social Security right. and all that stuff. So we've got those numbers somewhere. I mean, we every time we don't collect somewhere close to $100 a session, we're losing money.
You lose right. money, right.
Every single time. And so my HR person right now, even though I think this DSU model has worked pretty well over the years, it causes a lot of problems too. And our HR director now is pushing to get rid of it and try to go towards salary, because it causes a lot of challenges in terms of team stuff and people, you know, am I getting paid to go to this meeting?
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. So.
So I want to mention that Julie wants to say something. So Julie, you're here. Where are you?
Hi, thank you. Yes, I got a request to unmute my audio, and I just wanted to explain the reason why I had my audio muted. In Indianapolis, our JFS is a part of our federation, and we are not at this point billing insurance, Medicare, Medicaid at all. So all of our case management services are offered without a fee, but we know that we're trying to explore doing some kind. We're a very small agency. We're trying to explore sharing Medicare billing with our nursing home. And so our purpose of being on the call is to really get a better picture of how that works. And so that's why I was muted, because I don't have as much to add.
Okay, so are you getting your answer? Are you asking us a question?
No, I'm letting you, someone asked me to unmute, but the reason why I'm muted is because we're in a very different situation in Indianapolis. Oh. I just wanted to share our structure and to explain.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay, I muted you for a second, Elaine, because your phone's making noises. There you are. You can talk. Elaine.
Thank you. You have a lot of power, Lisa.
I know.
I was just saying that it was nice to hear Julie.
So, Jeremy, do you have anything you want to tell us, or, you know, about what's happening in Rhode Island? You have to unmute yourself.
So our experience has basically been reflected in the other organizations here. Like, we don't limit the low fee clients, but we end up with just the mid range anyways. Like it all kind of washes out, at least in the way that I see it, the way that it looks anyways. We have three salaried part-time clinicians, so they're not they work in a range of 20 to 24 or 28 hours. So it's an hourly rate, but it's a salaried position. They have access to benefits. And there's an expectation around like productivity. So the expectation of productivity is really about if you're working, say, 20 hours a week, take out supervision, take out clinical group supervision, and some other administrative kinds of things. And then you divide like how many clients they saw and how many hours are left. And many times, you know, if a clinician lands about, you know, 65% productivity, that there's a bit of profit that's made on for that clinician with those clients, but not much. It's slim. I do have one fee for service clinician who works 7 or 8 hours on a Monday, she's fairly easy to fill. But again, looking at reimbursement rates and then what we pay her, there's really a slim profit.
What do you pay her?
Yeah.
What is your fee for contract, social worker?
45.
That's, is that basically the going rate with what people are paying, 40 to 45?
It's actually a bit higher. We pay a bit higher fee for service than other organizations do. Mm-hmm. It was when I was brought into the organization, I was kind of shocked. Mm-hmm. Probably a good $5 to $10 more than what other organizations pay. But those other organizations, especially the larger ones that are much larger than we are really aggressive in that productivity number, even with fee-for-service folks are expected.
The people rather work for you.
Well, yeah. I think so. I have a good environment as well as just a really, we're just generous with employees. That's not how you make money, or at least sustain a budget. Though it's finding that balance of
right.
What's the added value to having a well-paid employee. you know, we can't sustain a program now.
Jeremy, I have a question about your productivity. It's very interesting to me. So what you're saying then is, for your salaried employees, there's an expectation of a 65% of direct service time.
Yes. Yep.
That's really interesting, because I suspect when we set up our DSU model, it was something like 70, I mean, the whole direct service unit was based on sort of a face-to-face client, and mm-hmm. then the other time for supervision. But it's intriguing to me to be able to build that into somebody's salary. So do they have to monitor that 65% direct service themselves, or do you do it, or how's that work?
I do it. I pull it out of our billing scheduling EMR program that we use, and it's just cranking out the math. It's like, how many clients did you see? How many hours did you have available to have clients in during your schedule? Right.
So if somebody works 30 hours a week,
yeah,
salary 30 hours a week, and then you figure out what, you know, 65% of that time would be face-to-face clients.
Yeah, well, and I'll take out things like, I have weekly supervision. We have weekly clinical group supervision.
Right, but that's not part of your 65%, right?
No, it's not. Yeah. So I take those out. So for somebody who works 30 hours, for example, their actual working ability to work hours might be closer to like 26. If they saw 20 clients and they had 26 hours available, I just do the division, and then that gives me a number.
You figure out 65% after you've taken out their supervision hours.
I do that as a little bit of a manipulation on my end. I do it as a protective factor so that my boss, the upper directors in the organization, I can, it's easier to, I mean, the number's still going to be the number no matter what, but how do I explain this? I do it as a way of encouraging clinicians to manage their own schedules, work their own schedule.
To
really encourage, so the numbers look good. So when clinicians are at 65 to 70 to 75% productivity, when I talk about like how well programs are doing or how busy clinicians are or what referrals look like, it's nicer to give that number. Because if I did the math on a 30-hour a week position and I kept in those times that they couldn't work, like we also have paid lunches, paid 45-minute lunches.
Right.
So all of these things are expected in times out of their day where they can't book a client. So if I just crank the math out on, they saw 20 clients in 30 hours. So that'd be like 60%.
That's a very interesting
way of presenting it.
Yeah, that's a very interesting model. So you get a salaried employee, you take out the time that they couldn't be seeing clients, which means they're feeling valued, you know, not like, am I getting paid for a meeting? They're feeling like that is being acknowledged, and then you say, of your remaining time, here's what we expect you to do.
And then to go to the how is it talked about? So I run the productivity piece, and then that just becomes part of the individual clinical supervision. And then, so if I notice that productivity over time or is trending a bit lower for whatever reason, for that becomes a topic where we chat about. And it's not from a corrective action plan kind of thing. It's just a, hey, what's up? What's happening? How can I best support? Is this, I'm not giving you referrals? Is it like, let's just problem solve it. Because I'm trying to avoid the conversation from my directors of like productivity.
Right.
I want my clinicians to feel like their work is good work, that they don't have to really feel like this is a grind, having to see as many clients as possible because they have to reach a certain percentage. But I want them to be aware that if you had a late, for example, have the front desk call three or four of your clients that might be able to shift to earlier in the week, or somebody maybe you haven't seen in a while, let the front desk know, let them call and see if they can work that person into that.
Right.
So that they're really active in saying, in invested in the productivity number. The other that I'm looking to implement is, and that's been successful in other organizations, is provide, so for clinicians who reach a certain productivity line, I don't know what the number is, but a friend of mine works at a different organization and they incentivize productivity with a $100 gift card per month. So if your average productivity for the month is like they used 70% or something like that, then it's the $100 gift card to like a Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks or someplace local, or it's a Visa card, and just incentivizes people to be creative about it. It's an extra $100. And
right.
But over the course of the year, that's an extra $1,200.
Right.
It's
nice.
And I'm looking at the time, it's 5 of, and I wanna make sure that people have an opportunity to also talk about whatever it is that they may be interested in. We have a lot of information on the chat, which I can actually condense and send out when I send the reminder so you can see what everyone has done, which I'll do. I don't know if Michael wants to talk or Rachel from New Orleans, Carla, Kate, anyone? Lauren?
Michael, yeah. Just a little, there's a lot of people trying to share their opinions. I can speak a little bit about what we do here at Ottawa. We have about 41 counselors in our team. Wow. We are, yeah, it's a big team. Not everyone's full-time. Everyone's a salaried employee. We do have a few what we call overflow. So this is when we've reached capacity and we can't take on the new calls. We would contract out to those overflow counselors. We have a sliding scale that ranges from $5 at the lowest, sometimes even zero if there's a specific need, to currently 130, although I'll be upping it up to 140 very soon. We base the sliding scale on the income of the household, so also depending how many people live in the family. If someone cannot, I'm trying to answer all the questions that came up. If someone cannot afford the fee that's assigned to them, and by the way, we do not verify. It's an honor system right now for all its pros and cons there. So if someone says that they cannot afford that, then the fee assessment is given in our intake department. And so the intake workers have some flexibility to decrease the rate a notch. So there's specific stages of the sliding scale. So it could be from 90 to 80, for example. If the client needs more, they will up it to me to look into that. Honestly, that doesn't happen very much. In fact, very often what happens is that clients, especially those that are being highly subsidized, when they hear the fee that they're being offered, they say, no, I can pay more. I can pay more than that.
Wow.
So
does that happen anywhere else?
Well, people appreciate the service that they're receiving, right?
Of course.
What else can I answer there? The clinicians do not deal with the fees at all. Everything happens at the intake. Even if at one point the fee needs to be reassessed because client went out of insurance or lost their job or something like that, the clinician would send the client back to the intake workers to reassess the fee. Clients pay at front desk before or after the session. We very rarely have clients who run away without paying. That doesn't really happen. When we look at our ratio, this is a sore point here. To be able to have a sustainable model, the ratio needs to be 3 higher fee sessions to 1 lower fee session. So 75% of the clients need to be higher fee. It doesn't necessarily happen that way. Some clinicians are struggling more with that. And so what we see is that the as a result, the ratio is more 1-to-1, which brings us to break even, as opposed to having a little bit of profit that allows us to continue and grow. What else would I say? There were a lot of questions that came up. We do try to limit our sessions to, this is something new that we've been trying to implement. The lower fee clients, we try to limit it to a 12 session model. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, if someone comes and they're having some significant issues and there's a big financial need, dire financial need, we're not that strict. There's going to be some flexibility. But using the 12 session model allows us to actually serve the lower fee clients who would not get the service otherwise, and still sustain a model that makes sense to us.
Michael, what is
Michael? Hold on for a second. Thank you so much for talking. What, Elaine?
Michael, I just wanted to one quick follow up question for him. When you say for your low fee clients, Michael, you try to limit to the 12 session model or the 25% of the caseload. What are you defining as the low fee?
So lower fee as opposed to low fee, lower and higher fee. Yeah. So on a scale between 130 or 140, depending how you want to look to it, to zero even, then we've put a cut at 90. So someone who pays over $90 is considered higher fee, and below that is lower fee.
So you limit people who pay less than 90 to 12 weeks, potentially. It's an interesting model.
Yes.
Of our lower paying clients, when I was an executive director, I mean, they would stay on for years because they were paying nothing. But I wanted to just say one thing, and I think it's important, and maybe you guys do this or you don't, but I think it's really important to reevaluate payment. And I don't know if a lot of people do that all the time. You know, they just sort of let it go and let it go when people get jobs or they can pay more, to actually do what you do, Michael, which is have them go to your intake worker, whoever, and to reevaluate. I think that was a really important point. Anyway.
Excellent.
There was a lot of interesting points today. I might have to listen to this again to write them down.
Actually, somebody asked Lisa whether or not they could get a recorded version of this. I think there was a lot of really important information.
Yes, this is recorded, and it will be up in the Affinity Group resource library. And when I send you the information and the directions as to how to do it, keep that somewhere because you can always go back to it. Nothing changes.
Lisa, what we did not do was to figure out, I think we're just about out of time, if anybody had a particular request of topic for next quarterly meeting. I had one question that I wanted to throw out to the group, and I don't know whether that would lead to the next meeting, but my question is, which I promised my PQI committee I would ask, is does any agency have a benchmark for how quickly you respond to a caller who's calling in for services? When somebody calls your agency asking for help, how quickly do you get back to them?
We try to answer a call within 48 hours, working hours, that is.
48 working hours. Anybody else have a benchmark?
It doesn't mean service initiation.
Right, just contacting them. Any other benchmark that people have? Carlos?
So we typically get back to 24 hours of call as long as it's within the work week.
How many? We couldn't hear you.
Within 24 hours. And again, that doesn't mean start of treatment or counseling. But then if the person goes on the wait list, whatever, we follow up with the person.
It's hard to hear you, Carlos. I don't know why.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
It's in and out.
Eve, what were you going to say?
Right. We have the same within 48 hours to contact somebody and make sure that they feel that they have been connected to.
Right.
And then usually within a week or two, we can try and get an appointment.
That's great. So here's what people said they were interested in. I'm looking at the survey. Growth of counseling programs, staff morale in a nonprofit, best practices on topics, program evaluation. I find it helpful when colleagues discuss common challenges and issues. Outreach in the Jewish community, clergy. Referrals, medication management, interdisciplinary team effectiveness. How's that?
We have so many things, Lisa.
Okay, we'll come up with something.
Right. Anybody here want to shout out what their top choices they want to say? Can we talk about it next time?
Nobody? Okay, email me or email Elaine if you have ideas. Okay?
Awesome, you guys.
Let us know how it was. Okay, thank you, Elaine. Can you stay on for 1 minute?
I can, Lisa.
Okay, terrific. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me put on my glasses. In the course of that conversation, this affinity group, I got 42 emails.
From people in the group?
No, not from the group. From, you know, just the agent, you know, people around the network and this conference, you know, there's just a lot of stuff sort of going on.
It's exciting.
It is exciting. It's exciting. I can't complain.
First of all, I have to thank you again now in person.
For?
Well, I don't want everybody to hear.
Okay.
They're listening. I have to have all of our friends say shalom to us.
Lisa, I sent you a private message. So I don't know if you didn't notice it probably because I just sent it.
So maybe you want to stay and talk with both Elaine and I.
That's sure.
That would be fine.
That'd be great.
Sure.
I cannot. The reality is it's so hard for me to watch the screen, to try to do the mute, and to look at the chat. It's almost impossible.
Okay, Beth. What do you want to talk to us about? Is Kate?
Okay. So she just said she wanted to talk about this group. Go on. Let's hear.
Oh yes. Yeah, so as I said initially, this is the first time we're part of the affinity group process.
Right.
And I just don't know if this is just related to the counseling services that the agencies do, because our agency does not provide any direct counseling services. As I said, we refer to our OMETS, sister agency, even for seniors. Is this all related to agencies that offer counseling or?
Yeah. This one is.
Yeah. Okay. What else does your agency do though?
We do extensive case management. One of our biggest funder is material claims.
Is there
Okay, listen, hold on. Someone was on the call, on the older adult services call this past week, which was great, from the Cummings Center, which was really good. And I think they liked it. I can tell you who it was if I can find my notes.
Trisha?
Potentially, yeah.
Trisha or Brenda Ewan?
I have to look. But I can tell you that we're starting February 11th or February 12th or something like that. I don't know the date. An emergency financial and case management professionals. Financial. So I think that would be beneficial to you because a lot of people are interested in that. And this isn't that. Older adults isn't that. You know, it's a whole different kind of staffing.
Right.
So if you send me the email, your email or whatever, and I can send you that information, or you'll see it when you get the NJHSA news.
Okay, so that's
perfect. It's not coming out this Friday, it's coming out next Friday with that information.
Okay, so was it Brenda Ewan that was on the older adult?
I had six affinity groups this week and now I have to find them.
Oh my God.
I know it was crazy.
It's a full-time job.
Brenda, I don't know, that's Philly. Okay, Detroit. What is the CJE? That's not it. Cummings. Brenda Ewan.
Right. So Brenda Ewan is our director of our program department, and that's providing activities, lectures, courses to seniors. It's not the social service end.
Okay.
So if you think that if there's the social service component in that, then maybe I would join it with her.
It was great. Ask her about it.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a good one.
I will. And I'm going to look out for the other one that you just said about case management and financial assistance.
But it was really nice having you today.
Thank you. It was so nice meeting all of you.
This was an interesting group. I thought it would be much more active, people would be much more communicative. And I wonder, I wonder if we should, if I should learn how to do polls. You had said something, and I've got something down here. Beth, you don't need to be on this anymore.
Okay.
Unless you want to, but
I'm going.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So we'll see you. Hopefully, I'll see you on another.
Actually, don't wait, Beth.
Oh, shoot, you guys, it's being recorded. I forgot to stop it.
Don't hang up.
Okay.
Beth.